Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Tim Watts. I'm the CFO of Shield Therapeutics and have been since August of this year. The first thing to say, as always, is there are some forward-looking statements in here and they cannot be relied upon. So let me first of all introduce you to Shield Therapeutics. We're an AIM-listed biotech company, market cap of around 39 million, bobbing between about 35 and 40 million pounds over the last few weeks. We're focused on developing and commercializing a product called Feraccru. This is a novel treatment for iron deficiency. Headlines recently are that we've outlicensed the product to Norgine for commercialization in Europe. We did that in September 2018. And a few weeks ago, we submitted an NDA to the FDA for approval in the US. And that's a process that, well, I'll come back to these processes, but it's ongoing over a few months. I would describe ourselves as a semi-virtual company at the moment. There are 15 people in the team. We outsource the heavy lifting of clinical trials and manufacturing and commercialization, clearly through out-licensing. The 15 employees, but within that, there's a pretty experienced management team. We'll touch on that towards the end of the presentation. And we have two small offices, one in London and one in Newcastle. The Norgine deal in September brought in £11 million up front, and when we put out the RNS about that, the words we said, I think, were that the company is funded for at least 12 months. So I think what I'd like to go into now is to tell you a little bit about iron deficiency and then where Feraccru sits in that. So some of these slides are quite detailed. They are as per the handout that I've got. If you want to come to the table outside later on, I'm not going to go through every word on these ones, but there is more information available if you need it. And also this presentation is on our website. But essentially, iron deficiency is caused by depletion of iron in the liver, and that means there's insufficient iron to form hemoglobin, red blood cells, and also other enzymes and things which require iron. Typically, you're going to absorb iron into the body through intake of food, be that meat or plants, and it then gets into the bloodstream where it is used. And of course, the issue is where iron, you get iron deficiency, where for whatever reason, you're not absorbing enough to satisfy the production that you need in the body. And it can be caused by a whole range of factors, including bleeding and malnutrition. But some key areas are the irritable bowel disease and chronic kidney disease are significant areas where people can develop iron deficiency. And if you get iron deficiency, you're likely to have anemia with it. So iron deficiency anemia is a phrase you'll hear quite a lot of. Broad range of symptoms, lots of obvious types of things like lethargy, fatigue, depression, and so on. Clearly, those are sort of indications that you get with many diseases. So sometimes it's not terribly well diagnosed, but that gives you a sense of the types of things that you might be suffering from. I mentioned irritable bowel disease and chronic kidney disease as reasons why people will develop iron deficiency. And what you can see from this slide is that there's a big market out there. So you've got IBD is the chart on the left. CKD, chronic kidney disease, is the one on the right. The dark blue is the US, and the lighter blue is the top five countries in the EU. May not be able to say that for too much longer, but... but what you can see is at the moment, there are about 3 million patients across those two universes with IBD and maybe around 12 million with chronic kidney disease. And over the next, well, up to 2035, that's expected to grow. That should have a percentage by 1.5% compound growth, 1.4%, mainly due to demographics. So there's a big disease areas out there, so this is a significant area. The reason I've gone out to 2035, by the way, is we have patent protection for Feraccru out to 2035. Iron deficiency it needs to be treated, and it's treated essentially with iron replacement therapy. Clearly, in the first instance, the physicians are going to try and treat the underlying cause, but if the iron deficiency or the anemia is causing enough issues, they may need to treat that as well as the underlying disease. And essentially, the therapy is either oral iron, which is see down here. In fact, and it's the most commonly used one, as you can see from the percentage chart on the left-hand side, or intravenous iron, IV iron. And essentially, you know, those are the two routes. But as we'll see, they've got drawbacks. These treatments are considered to be broadly safe, but oral iron can be quite slow to take effect. And it also creates, they're not well tolerated by patients. Somebody described it to me once as having to sort of take, you know, you're taking an oral lump of iron and trying to absorb that. And so tolerability is a key issue with 60 to 70% of patients not able to keep going through their course of treatment. If they move on to IV therapy, the efficacy is generally good and it's faster acting than the oral route. But of course, the issue you get with IV is you've got to go into hospital. It's inconvenient, it's costly, and so on. So there's two significant opportunities there in terms of tolerability and efficacy with the oral, and cost to attack on the IV front. So this is sort of how Feraccru fits in. So if you have a patient diagnosed with iron deficiency, then they'll go onto oral iron. Typically, if they're intolerant, then they might come down to IV iron. But we're saying there's a route here. If they are tolerant, that might be fine. But over prolonged usage, you might end up with gut damage to the gut and so on. And so people will be moved off oral iron onto IV. But again, clearly you've got the fact that it's a much more costly approach because you'd have to use hospital resources and so on. And patients don't want to be having to go in and out of hospital on a regular basis. And as I said, the Feraccru is patented until 2035. This is a bit of science, so I'm not going to go into this, but essentially the formulation of Feraccru is different to the formulation of the existing oral iron treatments. And as a result, it is extremely well tolerated. We'll see in a moment, there's some study results which show it's how well tolerated it is. And you don't get the issues that you see with existing oral therapies. So the data comes from clinical studies. The first one is a study that was completed earlier this year in chronic kidney disease. The primary endpoint was the change in hemoglobin from baseline, and the red is the placebo, blue is Feraccru, and you can see there's a very significant change in the amount of hemoglobin, which is what we were measuring. So it was fairly quick acting as well in terms of being noticeable at 4 weeks and 8 weeks, as well as the endpoint of 16 weeks. We've done another study this was an earlier study in irritable bowel disease. The top chart there shows you what happens over 12 weeks, and essentially you're getting a clinically relevant rise in hemoglobin over just a 12-week period. The middle chart then takes you out over 64 weeks, so you can see that rise is then sustainable, and indeed even patients who were on this therapy were not having to go on to the intravenous treatment. And this shows you the placebo-like safety. The red bars there are placebo, so you've got various events of headache, fatigue, constipation, diarrhea, and so on. And actually what you see is that the Feraccru-treated patients had fewer adverse events than the placebo-treated patients. So very good tolerability and safety profile. There are some other Feraccru studies. There's been a pediatric pharmacokinetic study. This is really a precursor to doing a phase 3 study in children. At the moment, we're approved in adults, that's 18 upwards. And the pharmacokinetic study achieved all the goals that we needed it to. And so, in fact, jumping just down here for a moment, we are planning now to for a phase three study in children, and expect, all being well, we have to develop the protocol, get it approved, so, but we have to start recruitment into that study in the second half of 2019. This is a study, the head-to-head study, H2H. This is a study comparing Feraccru against intravenous treatment. The idea is to show non-inferiority. We've actually finished recruiting the patients in September. I should put out an RNS to say that recruitment was completed. Some of those patients obviously have to go through their 12 weeks of treatment. So by the time that's done and then we've looked at the, get the data out, we expect results sometime in the first quarter of next year. And that will be, that study is important in particular because it will support pricing and reimbursement claims. I should say that at the moment in Europe, the drug is launched in the UK and Germany. It's generally in the pharmaceutical industry easiest to launch in the, those two markets because you can go in essentially with your own price. Whereas in the other major markets, France, Spain and Italy, you have to wait longer for pricing and reimbursement discussions. And Norgine, who are now our commercial partners, as did we, you know, view the, if we can get good data from the head-to-head study, then it'll support support those arguments. It's not the end of the world if we don't get the data we want, but it obviously helps if we do. So let's come on to European commercialization. I've just got really one slide. So we've granted Norgine an exclusive license to commercialize Feraccru in Europe, Australia and New Zealand. There is a small asterisk there. We had previously outlicensed Feraccru to a couple of smaller companies in Scandinavia and Switzerland. Norgine have got the license everywhere else in Europe. We got an £11 million upfront payment in September as a license payment. And the deal is structured such that there are potentially up to €54.5 million in various milestones. Some of those come from R&D. In fact, a small proportion, there's a €4.5 million that could come from various R&D events over the next 2 to 3 years. And the rest are sales milestones. So as the sales progress, 50 million, 100 million and so on, then that triggers milestone payments from Norgine to us. And we got a royalty structure ranging from 25% at the lowest level of sales up to 40% if the sales achieve over certain undisclosed levels. Norgine is a well-resourced, it's European-focused specialty pharma business. It's got a presence in the area that you need to have for Feraccru. They've got a proven commercial track record. It's got a turnover of about €400 million. So one of the reasons we chose Norgine is because this Feraccru has the potential to be quite significant in their terms. So they're clearly going to be motivated to make a success of it, as opposed to, for example, going to one of the major pharma companies for whom this would have been a sort of a rounding error and who therefore might lose interest. Norgine are responsible for the commercialization. We retain responsibility for the manufacture and supply of the product. We retain, frankly, the ownership of the intellectual property and therefore all the future development of the product is at our right and our responsibility. And we have full commercial rights to Feraccru in the countries that we haven't yet licensed it to, and that includes the USA, which I'll come on to. So fairly brief at this point in time, we filed the new drug application with the FDA in October. All being well, that could give us a potential approval of the product for marketing in the US the second half of 2019. So the board is currently assessing the commercial options, and broadly there are sort of three alternatives. One is to out-license it completely and just say to another company, here you are, you know, take this away and sell it, and you know, we'll have to take from that an upfront and some royalties. At the other end of the spectrum, we could self-commercialize, go it alone. We set up ourselves a marketing company and market the product ourselves. and I guess you've obviously got them, you know, at the out-license end, it's the sort of low risk, lower reward. Self-commercializing would be higher risk, but conversely higher reward as well. But there might be something in the middle, a joint venture type of structure where perhaps we co-promote or we carve up the segment and maybe Shield could build a small selling and marketing operation, but leave some heavy lifting to a US partner. But these are discussions which the board is still going through. So just a few financial headlines. So at the end of June 2018, the company had £3.5 million on the balance sheet. But we received the £11 million up front that I mentioned from Norgine in September. And the cash runway that we said at the time that we are funded for at least 12 months. So we're for a biotech still involved in development, we're in a reasonably strong position. I'm not going to go through all this detail, but just to say it's in the booklet, but Carl Sterrett is the CEO and co-founder, founded the company in 2008. And he'd had various previous roles. but Mark Sampson, the chief medical officer, Jackie Mitchell, who's the VP of regulatory affairs and quality, and David Childs, who, you know, I guess you might say, you know, they are the technical senior management of the company. If you look through, you know, you've got, you know, SmithKline, Amgen, you've got Boehringer Ingelheim and Abbott, GSK. So there's plenty of big company as well as small company experience in here, and people who understand what it takes to get drugs developed and approved in the US market or in all markets. Lucy Bailey is the general counsel, company secretary, and she's had a range of experience in law firms before joining the company. And I've joined as an interim CFO, I've had big and small company experience before Shield. Anticipated news flow. So sometime in the next few weeks, we should have we should hear from the FDA that they have accepted our filing of the NDA submission. During the first quarter, we expect, as I said earlier on, to have the results from the head-to-head study against IV iron. In the third quarter, we could have the potential, what's known as the PDUFA date from the FDA, which is for US approval. Sometime in the second half of next year, start the pediatric phase 3 study, which would that's not going to happen overnight. It's probably going to be about a 2-year study, but it would mean that by 2022, perhaps, we can broaden the use of Feraccru into children as well as in adults. And ongoing and ad hoc further out licensing agreements in other territories that might, as we talked about earlier, that might include the USA, but there are clearly other territories around the world apart from the ones Europe and Australia where we've already out licensed. So there's more to go at in those areas. So the key messages I'd like to leave you with: iron deficiency is a major market, and it's got some significant unmet needs in terms of the tolerability issues and in terms of the cost of the IV treatment. Feraccru is novel. We've now got this broad approval in Europe. Norgine commercialization agreement is in place. We've got the submission in for the US, and we're looking at further licensing opportunities elsewhere. We've got the cash runway extending at least 12 months. And we would believe that there is valuation upside. The current market cap, as I said earlier on, is 39 million. I'm sure you will all be familiar with the difficulties with MiFID II now in terms of having analyst research. We're covered by Peel Hunt and Liberum. Liberum are Nomad. And since the Norgine deal, those two analysts have come up with valuations of in the 80 million to 90 million range, so suggest and that that explicitly excluded any US opportunity. So if we get the US approval, there's potentially even more to go at on top of that. So with that, I'd like to thank you very much for coming.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.